to today's presentation. So our speaker is Robert Enright, and he is going to present today on forgiveness for individual, family, and community well-being, which relates to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison and the founding board member of the International Forgiveness Institute, Inc. in Madison, Wisconsin. It's www.internationalforgiveness.com. His current research centers on forgiveness education for elementary school students, which is very important, in Hong Kong, Israel, Palestine, and Northern Ireland, and also forgiveness therapy for imprisoned, those imprisoned, and those without homes. So without further ado, I will go ahead and let you take it away.
Thank you very much, Renee, and thank you to all of you for being here. As Renee said, I study the psychology of forgiveness in the Department of Educational Psychology. And I started that because everybody at the time when I came here, when they were studying moral issues, would study justice or how people are fair to one another. And I did the same thing, and I got tenure doing that, and I had grants studying how people are fair to one another. And I woke up one day and I asked myself a very dangerous question. My very dangerous question was this: who am I helping with my research? And my answer, truthfully, was, well, a few of my academic buddies. We meet maybe twice a year at different conferences, pat ourselves on the back, and tell us each other how great our work is, and we go back to our own laboratories. And so when I came to that answer, I threw all of my research over a cliff. And so I started asking this question: what in the area of moral development might be of help to people in the world? And the idea of forgiveness kept coming up for me, because I thought of that as, shall we say, the flip side of justice. What do you do when you're treated unjustly? How do you climb up out of the pit when people are brutal to you, terribly unfair to you? How do you heal from that? And so in 1985, 36 years ago now, I started talking with graduate students and they became interested. I had a student from Saudi Arabia, one from Greece, one from Taiwan, Korea, the United States, all over the world, with different philosophies and worldviews and faiths or no faiths at all. And we started what we call the Friday Forgiveness Seminar in 1985, where we asked three questions. First of all, what is forgiveness? Second, how do you go about forgiving when people have been really unfair to you? And third, what happens in a psychological sense when you forgive? And that Friday Forgiveness Seminar is still going on 36 years later, of course, with a different cast of characters, because the graduate students then have all grown up, so to speak, gotten their degrees and off they go. And we have a new set of people who are visiting scholars, who are graduate students, and some people just sitting in. And I'm a very, very slow learner, because we're still asking the same three questions. What is forgiveness? How do you go about it? And what happens when you do? And I'm glad we're doing this on Valentine's Day, because I am not just a psychologist, but someone who uses philosophy to understand these three questions. And my bedrock philosopher, to whom I owe a great deal of debt, is the great Aristotle from ancient Greece. And the term forgiveness actually in Aristotelian language means largeness of heart. So here we are on Heart Day talking about largeness of heart, or magnanimity is what the English translation from the ancient Greek is. Magnanimity is largeness of heart. That's basically what forgiveness is toward those who've been really mean to you. And even modern philosophers, we had a international conference at the University of Wisconsin in 1995, 26 years ago, and a preeminent philosopher from London, Joanna North, talked. And she basically is saying that forgiveness is a change of heart toward those who've hurt you. So it's heart day. And Aristotle would understand that. And modern philosophers would understand that. And because I owe a debt to philosophy in my psychology, I understand that. I also understand that forgiveness truly is extremely important in this troubled, difficult world. Just two examples before we launch into our three questions. What is it? How do you go about it? And what happens when you do? Just two examples. I was talking recently with a 35-year-old woman whose husband abandoned her, and she has two children, and she didn't have a full-time job outside of the home. And she said to me, "I do not have time to forgive. I am too busy. I've never learned that pathway. I wish I did, because now I am so burdened, tired, and furious. I'm not sure I know how to do this." And so she has to start from square one. And that's why we do forgiveness education in conflicted zones of the world, so that when these children grow up and the storms of life hit them, they'll have heard about it. And they won't say necessarily, "I hope, I don't know how to do this." And so part of my largeness of heart is for children in conflict zones. And another example is, as Renee had said, we work in correctional institutions. And I was recently in a maximum security prison for men. They had just finished 6 months of forgiveness therapy. And there was a gentleman who was part of the group who's in for life. He's not getting out. And he said to me, "If I had had forgiveness training when I was 12 years old, I would never be here. My fury would not have been unleashed onto other people." Sadly, it's too late for that. And now he has unleashed that fury with very violent crime, and he's not going to get out, and he knows that. And so I give you these two stories on Heart Day to let you know how very, very important this theme of forgiveness really is. So let's go to our three questions. First, what is it? The great Aristotle would tell us to never start discussing any theme until we know what it is. And so I have studied forgiveness from as many kinds of sources that I possibly can: humanism, ancient Greek philosophy, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. And I've come to the conclusion that forgiveness involves three things that I think would be acceptable to the humanist, the modern and traditional philosopher, the three monotheistic traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism. And here is that definition. Three elements to the definition. First, when you engage in forgiveness, you are dealing with a moral virtue, which is goodness toward others, as is justice and patience and kindness. And forgiveness, as this first point, is goodness specifically toward someone who has not been good to you. So there's been an injustice in your life. Second of all, when you forgive, you consciously and deliberately try to get rid of the negative. And the negative usually is what we call resentment, which is a hardness of heart, in contrast to the softened heart that Joanna North, the philosopher, talks about. So we try to get rid of the hardened heart toward the one who hurt us. And third, because forgiveness is a moral virtue, and this is where forgiveness gets very controversial, we try as forgivers to give good things to the one who hurt us. That might be kindness, respect, generosity, or love even. And when I talk about the goodness side of things, that's when it gets controversial, because people tend to clench their fist and say, how dare you say that? Why would you want me to be good to those who aren't good to me? Forget it. I'm going to encapsulate my heart in stone toward this person. But that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is magnanimity of heart. It's largeness of heart. But what might make forgiveness not quite so controversial is that there are four things it's not. Forgiveness is not finding an excuse for the other's behavior. When you forgive, you realize what the other did to you was unfair. It is unfair, and it will always be unfair, even if you forgive. The act itself was unfair, and it's going to stay that way. You don't find excuses. You see, forgiveness is toward the person. It's not toward the act itself. Because the act itself is done. It's gone. It's in our past. We can't get someone from the university to build us a time machine and go back there and fix it. That was wrong, is wrong, and will always be unwrong. We don't excuse. Second, we really don't forget. At least I have found that in my 36 years of studying forgiveness. You know, we use the expression, oh, forgive and forget. What I find when we forgive is we remember in new ways. When we look back and we look at the person, we don't have this stony, cold, encapsulated heart anymore. We remember what happened to us, but without the rancor, if you will, without that resentment. Also, when we forgive, we may or may not reconcile with the one who hurt us. It is distinctly possible that no matter your best efforts with the one who hurt you, you simply can't be with that person because they keep abusing you. And so as you forgive and they keep hurting you and the trust breaks down, and that person does not want to build trust with you again, you might want to reconcile, but you can't, because reconciliation is a two-way street. It involves both of you and a commitment from both of you. And if one of you isn't playing by the rules, if one of you is not willing to meet in the middle and to trust each other with mutual respect, then you can forgive and not reconcile. That's one of the controversies, because so many people equate forgiving and reconciling. They'll say to me, how dare you talk about forgiveness when I've been in an abusive relationship for 5 years and I've been trying to get out of that. Now you're talking to me about forgiveness and you want me to go back into that where I've been physically abused and emotionally abused? And right, you're dangerous and your message is dangerous. Well, no, because forgiveness and reconciliation are different. Forgiveness is a moral virtue of goodness offered whenever you wish, your choice, no demand. Reconciliation is a negotiation strategy between two or more people to come together again in mutual respect, maybe even mutual love. And a fourth thing that forgiveness is not, and again, I've learned this from the great Aristotle, who reminds us you do not practice any of the moral virtues in isolation from any of the other moral virtues. When you forgive, you do not throw justice under the bus. When you forgive, justice and forgiveness should grow up together. So if you're forgiving someone who's verbally abusive to you, as an example, if you choose, yes, you can forgive that person, but ask something of that person. Let that person know that they can't keep treating you that way. You are a person of respect. And what you're asking is, if you're going to be interacting with this person, you want them to stop that unfairness, to stop that injustice. And what I find is, if with the magnanimity of heart, with the softness of heart, where you forgive first, how you ask for that fairness may be qualitatively different than if you approach the other with a stony, cold heart. Maybe that's encapsulated with resentment and sometimes even hatred. That for which you ask injustice, in justice, may be very different when you have the largeness of heart compared to when you want the eye for an eye. Question one, what's forgiveness? It's being good to those who aren't good to you, knowing you've been treated unfairly, getting rid of the resentment and offering goodness. You don't excuse, forget, necessarily reconcile, and you don't abandon justice. That's what forgiveness is. And I think if we had a humanist, an atheist, an agnostic, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist person all sitting around this table, I think we could all agree with that and have a civil conversation about what forgiveness is. Because forgiveness as a moral virtue has a certain universal aspect to it. So that's our first question. Second question, how do you do it? I'm guessing that there are a number of ways. As a psychologist, I started studying case studies of people who have forgiven, and we've come up with what we call a process model. And we've brought this model, this pathway, this roadmap to hundreds of people. And we ask, well, what do you think? Would this roadmap, if you get in your forgiveness car, would it bring you to a destination called forgiveness? And we reworked it, retooled it. And so we think we have a pathway that is not the definitive pathway. It's not the only way to forgiveness, but it is one scientifically supported roadmap that successfully gets people to forgiving, where they try and do get rid of the resentment and offer goodness to those who've hurt them. So here, there's 20 steps, and I'm not going to give you all 20 steps. I'm going to give you the gist of this process model of forgiving so that you can remember some of these points and even start thinking about forgiving someone on Heart Day today, right? We have what we call four phases to forgiving: the uncovering phase, the decision phase, the work phase, and the discovery phase. Uncovering, decision, work, and discovery. So what's the uncovering phase? The uncovering phase is, you know you have identified a person who's hurt you, and you know the person was unfair, and you know the context of what happened. But we don't dwell on that. We don't re-traumatize. We now ask the person to look at the effects of what happened on you as a person, as a unique, special person. What are the effects of that which happened to you? And that might have happened to you at age 6. Or 16, or yesterday. Right? We usually ask people to pick a person who's hurt them, and then we ask some of these effects. How's your heart doing in terms of level of anger or sadness toward this person? If you've ever had a sports injury and you go into sports medicine, they have on the wall the 1 to 10 scale. They say, how much pain are you in? 1 to 10. We ask, you know, how much anger do you have, 1 to 10? How much sadness do you have? Might just be you can't even label it that. How much disruption do you have, 1 to 10? And if it's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10, that can be disruptive. We ask, has it affected you in any way? Is any like physical challenges because of this? And the most pressing physical challenge we find is fatigue. When you carry a sack of woes on your back, sometimes for years, it can get heavy and people get tired. Another thing we find, and this is very, very important because most people aren't aware of it, one effect when you've been treated terribly unfairly by others is what we call your worldview changes. And your worldview, which might have been a view of hope, things can get better. Oftentimes people, imperfect as they are, try to help and to be good in this world. Oftentimes changes to a pessimism that you now, as the non-forgiver, have without even realizing it. Everyone's just out for themselves. The bottom line is me. People tend to be kind of selfish, so I have to watch my back. Right? Entering into another relationship, forget about it. You know why? When someone has a lack of trust and damages your trust, oftentimes without forgiveness, your trust is not restored toward others. You see, the lack of trust generalizes where you won't get close. And forgiving can actually change that for the good, not naively. But those are some of the effects that can happen when others treat you unfairly. I wish the world didn't work that way. You know, I wish the world worked that whenever someone treated me unfairly, the excess baggage of effects is theirs. But unfortunately, when people treat you unfairly, they usually walk away from that. They're not even thinking about it anymore. If it happened in childhood, if you brought something up, the person wouldn't even remember it. And the effects are yours. And so we ask people to look at those, and then we ask how, then we go to the decision phase, second of four phases. Well, how are you doing with all that? Do you have a good way of coping with all of that? Maybe you have a good jogging program. Maybe you talk with friends. See, forgiveness is not the only way, right? But a lot of times, I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Wisconsin, so I can do therapy as well as my research. And a lot of times, people tell me, I've tried everything under the sun, and I'm still burdened by the resentment. I have no cure for it. I'm simply living with it. And so we ask in the decision phase, are you willing to try forgiveness as a possibility? We go through the definition. We tell them that the science shows that you really could be unburdened of those effects. Your worldview might change. The anger and sadness actually could melt. Would you like to try it? It's all your choice, free will. Nobody should pressure you into this. If the person says yes, then we enter the work phase. We hit the forgiveness gym. We build our forgiveness muscles. And that can be kind of scary. If you've ever started a physical exercise program, if you enter into the gym for the first time and you see all these whirling machines, you don't know how to use them, it can be overwhelming. If you've never really thought about forgiveness much or tried it much, it can be overwhelming. So we have to be gentle here as we enter the work phase. We have to give people time to be ready for it. But when they are ready to hit the forgiveness gym and become forgivingly fit, we start with thinking exercises, not feeling exercises, because you're more in control of your thinking than your feeling. If I say to you, if you're sad today, for your emotional exercise, don't feel sad. Forget it. It's not going to happen, right? Because we're not in such control of our emotions. But if I say, think of a pink elephant sitting on an orange tree, there you go. You can do that because you are more in control of your thinking. So we ask three kinds of thoughts specifically about the person who hurt you. These three are called the personal, the global, and the cosmic perspectives. Personal, global, and cosmic perspectives. And the personal perspective is to personalize the person who hurt you and try to understand their journey of walking with woundedness. Because, you know, a lot of times people who wound us have been wounded by others. And most of the time we know those who've hurt us, not always, but a lot of times we do. And so we ask, what is the history of how this person has been treated by others up to the point where they hurt you? And you'd be surprised when people dig into that about how wounded the people are who wound you. And so we see how they've been raised in childhood, or how they've been bullied on the playground, or how their boss is always on them and on them and on them. Okay? Or maybe how they've been suffering with a challenging physical ailment, so their reserves are low. But we want you to see the suffering or the woundedness in the one who wounded you. That's the personal perspective. Then comes the global perspective. And this ties right into one of the themes at your Unitarian Universalist Assembly, that we all have inherent or built-in worth. And we ask, once they've seen a wounded person, do you see a person who has great similarities to you? Right? Let's talk to the atheist about that, okay? Do you have unique DNA? How about the one who hurt you? Does the person who hurt you have unique DNA? You mean you both have unique DNA? When you cut, do you bleed? When the other is cut, does that person bleed? When someone's mean to you, do you hurt? When someone's mean to that person, does that person hurt? Are you both going to die one day? We can talk to a humanist. We can talk to a religionist. We can talk to an atheist. And the answer is yes to all these questions, you see, which makes all of us special, unique, and literally irreplaceable in this world. So we ask, are you, the one who might be going through forgiveness therapy with me, special, unique, and irreplaceable? Yes. Is the one who hurt you special, unique, and irreplaceable? Yes. But that might take months to sink in. See, it's not just asking a question and then boom, the light goes on. Say, I forgive you, man. No, it's not that simple. To change the mind and the heart this way takes time. So then we have now the personal perspective and the global perspective, where we see the woundedness in the other, shared wounds and shared humanity, shared inherent worth. And then we go to the cosmic perspective only if a person has a transcendent perspective beyond the material. Otherwise, we leave it with the two. But if the person has a transcendent perspective, we might ask something like this. Let's say I'm working with a Jewish client. I would say, well, what do you know about being made in the image and likeness of God from your ancient text in Genesis 1, the first book of the Hebrew scriptures? It says we're all made in the image and likeness of God. So are you made in the image and likeness of God? Yes, the Jewish person would say. Well, if you read that, does that mean the one who hurt you is made in the image and likeness of God? Gulp, gasp, yeah, I guess so. And then I point out, if I'm working with a Jewish client, that that theme of being made in the image and likeness of God is repeated in Genesis. Excuse me. So that what we have here now, when we put it all together, is a wounded person who wounded you, where you both have inherent or built-in worth, where you're both special, unique, and irreplaceable, and there's something spiritual about both of you, right? In the Jewish tradition, both made in the image and likeness of God. So what does that mean for who this person is? What does that mean for who you are as a person? And only when a person is strengthened in their cognition do we then ask the person, focus on your heart now. And how much your heart like toward the person when I tell the story of who this person is, and I go through how they might have been bullied on the playground. They have unique DNA as you do, and both in this case made in the image and likeness of God. And we see compassion emerging. Compassion is to suffer with. But you don't bring that up right away, because the stony cold heart can't receive that message. But remember, the great Joanna North, the philosopher from England, says part of what forgiveness is a change of heart. And so we go to that emotion and focus on the heart, and that takes time. But even a little movement of that heart toward a little bit of sympathy or empathy or willing to suffer along with the person can work wonders. And then we ask the person, and this is based on psychologists and psychiatrists' recommendations, to bear the pain of what happened, to stand up with the pain, let the pain be yours, and don't throw it back to the one who hurt you. And that's the beginning of the transition of therapeutic improvement. Because the person now is standing in the pain for the other, so the person doesn't throw it back to that other or to others. Why was my friend in maximum security prison in for life? Because he didn't bear the pain. He threw it onto many others with a rifle. Had he been able to bear the pain for the one who hurt him, he would have been giving a gift to many other people who would be alive today. So we don't put our pain onto others, and we deliberately make that choice, and we see our self-esteem starts to improve at that point. And then once a person is strong enough to stand up to the pain for the other, so you don't pass that pain to that person or to your family or to your loved ones, or like this gentleman, to others in a mall, right? We ask you to consider fulfilling the essence of what this moral virtue of forgiveness is, which is to give something good, give a gift to the other. It might be a smile, might be a return phone call. If the person is deceased, it might be donating money to charity in the person's name, or a kind word about the person. Which then brings us to the discovery phase, finding meaning in what we've suffered. When I work with the men in the maximum security prison, you know what they tell me? I'm now more sensitive to other people's pain in this correctional institution. I'm more sensitive to pain having gone through this. And in this discovery phase, people develop new purpose. So many of the men tell me, I now, even though I'm in for life, have a goal in this correctional institution, which is to help others to forgive in ourselves, so that they can be free of the burden. I'm doing it for them, not for me. And what we find at the end of the discovery phase is release from one's own emotional prison, which gets actually to our third point. What happens when people forgive? We've done a lot of randomized experimental and control group studies. Incest survivors, people in drug rehab, as I've said, maximum security prison. We've worked with acid burn victim women in Pakistan. We've worked with eighth graders in the three largest cities of Iran. We've worked with children in war-torn Belfast. And what we tend to find is when people willingly go through forgiving, and we see how they do relative to a control group that doesn't have forgiveness yet, self-esteem goes up, they start liking themselves, anger goes down significantly, anxiety goes down significantly, even psychological depression, which is hard to treat, goes down significantly, and hope for the future goes up. Just one example. We did a one-year follow-up of the acid burn victims in Pakistan. Those who were treated at the treatment center in Lahore, Pakistan, didn't have forgiveness, were declining in hope. Right? Acid burning is when a partner throws acid into the face of the former partner, disfiguring and maybe blinding. Their hope was actually deteriorating. Those who had forgiveness were still hopeful and going up in their hope. because they know there's something better for them, even though they've been disfigured. So forgiveness can be a restorer of one's well-being. It can actually cure hatred. It can cure resentment. And that's why it's the pandemic, I can't do it now. I fly around the world twice a year and give talks like I'm giving to you today about this very thing, because forgiveness is like a bottle of pills against the disease that can kill. And most people in the world don't know about this bottle of pills. And I find that tragic. I want people to know that there is a cure for resentment that can restore them and restore relationships and quite literally put more love in the world. Because at the end of the day, when we've been brutalized, when we die, we can leave a legacy of our anger to our children and our children's children's children, or we can leave more love in the world so that when you're no longer here in this world, 100 years from now, that love that you started to plant literally could be alive and well in the hearts of others, because love has an eternal quality to it, right? And your love now could be alive and well 100 years from now. And I wonder if you've ever thought about that. And I'd like to stop here and entertain questions, doubts, difficulties, anything at all. Well, let's wait a little bit. Yeah, it's forgiveness is a free choice. Asking a question is a free choice. Nope. But here's the deal. There is a philosopher in Canada named Trudy Govier, G-O-V-I-E-R, and she talks about primary, secondary, and tertiary forgiveness. Primary is if someone robs you, it's direct in toward you. And I've been talking about that. Secondary forgiveness is if someone hurts your loved one. The person didn't hurt you, but you've been upset by that. And tertiary, which is your issue now, is when someone you may never meet engages in an injustice, can you forgive that person? And the answer is absolutely yes. Why? Because they have hurt you. They have been unfair to you. And the deal there is, if you forgive there, you're not necessarily doing it to reconcile with someone, because you're not necessarily going to go to Washington. But at the very least, that kind of excess baggage that is left with you now because of the injustices you have walked, okay, over these, you know, past years, you will have a chance not to be disquieted by them or brought low by them, by the actions. And so tertiary forgiveness is a perfectly legitimate issue, even though the person did not personally, concrete, directly hurt you. So I'd say go for it. You can go for it with these kind of processes we talked about today. But see, here's the deal with regard to anger and justice. Forgiveness does not ask you to get rid of healthy anger. There's a difference between healthy anger and unhealthy anger. Remember, when we forgive, we do continue fighting for justice. So this idea of a righteous anger says, I am fueled by my short-term anger. But if we let that anger take hold of our heart, and it's with us for months and is very, very heavy, that is not going to help you in the political arena. You're going to probably have to take a nap. You're going to have to revitalize your energy. So when we take a look at the kind of anger, the righteous anger versus the unhealthy anger, sure, short-term anger, as you said yesterday, see, it fueled you. Your adrenaline got going because you said, here is a debate in which I want to enter in. Great. But at the same time, if you stayed with the kind of anger you had yesterday, with the adrenaline pumping for 6 months, it probably wouldn't be good for your cortisol levels, for your blood sugar, your blood pressure. And so you have to bring that down to a degree, but not forget justice. 100%. And that's why we have a term for that. It's called pseudo or false forgiveness. If I'm a politician and say, I want you to can't to forgive me for all that I've done so that I can keep doing it. Okay. And now you're a bad person if you don't forgive. That's false seeking forgiveness. You shouldn't let me get away with that. But that shouldn't condemn forgiveness as a moral virtue when done correctly. You see, we have to be careful with that. So I think you're raising a really, really important point that we have to be careful not to accept the false forms of it. Because see, there can be false forms of my forgiving too. I might go to my boss, I need the job, and I say, oh, forgive me for not getting that job report in on time. I'll do much better. Forgive me, when I really hate the guy. Okay, that's not true forgiveness. Forgiveness is has an act of sense of truth to it. It's an act of sincerity. But so should apology, because I think that can do more harm than good. You know why? That's a second offense. That's another offense toward you. So you could genuinely forgive the person for trying to fake you out in this idea of the false seeking forgiveness and putting pressure on you. I have a book called Forgiveness is a Choice. And I deliberately entitled it that way so no one feels the pressure. So I'm glad you raised that question. Absolutely. Yeah, I think the idea of false forgiveness, I'm glad you brought it up because I didn't. You're right. False forgiveness is not the real deal. And so we have to search for the real deal to make sure we're engaging in this as a moral virtue, as well as the seeking of forgiveness. That needs to be genuine as well. Like Lech Wałęsa did, actually, when he was the president of Poland. And he asked the Jewish people sincerely for forgiveness for how the Polish people, the government, did not handle the Holocaust. And that was quite sincere. Bill Clinton did the same with regard to slavery. And so the seeking of forgiveness was, from what I could tell, seemed quite genuine there. But when we get into the false forms, we have to say, hey, wait a minute. It seems to me you don't really mean this. And there was, he's no longer among the living, R.C. Hunter, who was a psychiatrist who in 1978, a long time ago, talked about false forgiveness. And he said, it has a certain insincere quality to it. And you don't have to be clinically trained to pick it out. He said, you can kind of sense it. And I think he's right. So thanks for the ideas.
Well, thank you, Robert, for your talk and for Penny and Kent responses.